The House Transportation Committee will come to order and welcome everybody. We have quite an agenda, so we'll get started and see how fast we can move through this. I think right now I know we have Senator Monroe who's here, if he would like to come up. And I'm going to go ahead and ask Pat Wrighton if he'd come up with him. And I don't see Senator Verger yet, so. Welcome.
Thank you.
Senator Verger, if you want to come on up.
Want me to take off?
Sure.
Thank you very much. I'm Rod Monroe, Senate District 24, which is East Portland and Happy Valley. And I was the only senator that regularly attended the visioning meetings chaired by Dick Wrighton that took place all last summer at the governor's request, putting together a package that he has submitted to you for consideration. Senator Verger was often with us by phone, and you, Madam Chair, were there most of the time, and I appreciated your input as well. I believe that the governor did this right. He appointed a committee that included all of the interest groups that had an interest in transportation, not just the highway users, not just the truckers, not just AAA, but the environmental groups, the bike ped people. He even let Metro in the room. I can say that because I was 12 years a Metro counselor in charge of transportation. So I really was pleased to participate because I felt like the governor was doing this right. He also staffed the visioning committee with some of the brightest assistants that he had. Hans and Chris did an outstanding job. And, of course, Dick did a great job as chair. The thrust was to come up with a major transportation package in the neneighborhood of $500 million to fund roads, bridges, but also transit, and also enhanced bike ped opportunities and so on. So the entire and rail. Let's not forget rail, especially since Washington is stealing their train back and we have to buy a new one to replace it for that Eugene-Portland run. The net result of my input, I think, was to say to the visioning committee, and I think they agreed, that we were not there to punt something onto the ballot. And this has happened too often in the past. I really believe, and it's a philosophical thing with me, that I get elected because the voters think maybe I have a little bit of wisdom and a little bit of judgment, and they expect me to make decisions, not punt every tough decision onto the ballot. So that's my philosophy. From a practical standpoint, any increase in fees or taxes is probably going to be defeated if it's on the ballot. And so what do we need to do? We need to make sure that all of the interest groups that might be interested in referring something to the ballot are on board and agree with the overall package. That's critical. Those people that have the wherewithal to buy their way onto the ballot need to be on board. So you need to keep that always in mind. The other thing is, if we really believe in the final analysis that whatever we do is going to get referred, then you might want to consider breaking it up into a number of different bills so they can't refer everything, or if they do, it gets watered down. I hope that doesn't happen. I would much rather we would just go through with a sound package that makes sense. There's a couple of elements that it has to include. I worked 12 years at Metro trying to develop new light rail lines and funding for those lines. It was always difficult to get the 40% match, because we have no sales tax like other states, and because the highway fund is locked up and can't tap that. So putting together 40% of $1 billion just from piecing local revenues is difficult. But that's not enough. That is not enough because the federal government not only requires a 40% match, they require you to prove that you got the money to operate the thing once it's built. That's why the payroll tax element in the governor's package is so important and must be included. Now, we have another major problem that is growing, and I can feel it growing because I'm getting older, and that's elderly and handicapped transportation. It's always been funded by a small part of the cigarette tax, but it's not enough, and it's a declining revenue source. So the governor has included, as was requested by the visioning committee, 2.5 cents for an addition for elderly and handicapped transportation. I don't think that's enough. I think it ought to be a nickel. If there is a cigarette tax package, and I believe there will be, a 50 or 60 cents that will come out of this legislature, a nickel of it ought to be dedicated to elderly and handicapped transportation. We're all getting older, and the baby boomers are aging, and the need for elderly and handicapped transportation is critical. When people can no longer drive their car, this is the only opportunity they have for getting around. But with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer questions, or we can turn to my colleagues.
We'll go ahead and go to Senator Berger.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Gilman, members of the committee, I'm very happy to be here today. I'm Joanne Berger, and I represent Senate District 5, which is from Coos Bay to Lincoln City. Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Gilman, I want to commend you for holding hearings on the governor's package. I, too, was impressed by the diversity of the people who have their handprints on this discussion. I look at the governor's package, and we call it the governor's package, but as Senator Monroe pointed out to me today, this was a lot of ideas that came, and the governor accepted those ideas from these committees that worked very, very hard. And so I believe that this is a point of beginning of a conversation. What I really hope happens is that all of you have your handprints on it as well, and that you approve and disapprove of parts of the package. For instance, there are things in the package like the Road User Fee Task Force. I'm on that task force. I was appointed for 13 years. I've served, I think, 5 or 6. That is a very futuristic idea. It is one that will come into its own someday, but maybe this is not the right time.
Yep.
And so as we look at some of the things that are in the transportation package, they will be that way. They'll not be things that you will feel is the right time now for that to happen. I would certainly hope that we would not eliminate things that we can appreciate, like Connect Oregon, for one, and I'm sure that that will be in the package. But I think at the same time, I want to remind those of us who have been around transportation for a long time, and that is that the Oregon Department of Transportation has really been up to the challenges. Whatever we have given them, whether it was Connect Oregon, whether it was OTIA, they've been able to run with it and take those ideas that the legislature has for the packages and do it. Our challenge, as all of you know, and I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, is the economy. And it's the times that we're faced with, and how do we fund a transportation package at a time like this? I've suggested to several of you that we can do some creative things, for instance, with the registration fee. We don't have to do it every 2 years. We can do it every 4 years. So I think if I can just encourage you to think in those ways rather than just what we've always done. But I think that will be a challenge. And because we do have the initiative and referendum, we all live a little bit in angst about that and what we do and the decisions that we make. But I would encourage you not to focus too much on that. I think we need to focus on doing the very best thing that we can do and then let the chips fall where they may. Mm. If we communicate well with our public as to what we're doing, then we may be surprised we may find that even if it went to the ballot, that we would have a lot of public behind us. So I don't think, in my determination of looking at the package and the things that I'm going to approve with, I'm not going to have that hanging over my head. I'm going to do what I feel is the best, and I would encourage you to do the same thing. As a long-standing member of transportation, I have truly appreciated the kind of work that many people have done. So we have a good base to build on. I would, just before I close, Madam Chair, I'd just like to say that I'm not real excited about a transportation commission. I think we have a transportation commission, and I think that that was one of the things that is listed. And so those are the kind of things I think we need to kind of sort out with the transportation package. I just want to pledge to you, Madam Chair, I know you have a work group working, but I want to pledge to you my full cooperation in working through and reaching a successful transportation, maybe Jobs and Transportation Act of 2009, which I like very well, and I think that that will play well with our public, and I think it should be true. If we say that we're going to put out a package that produces jobs, then we had better put out a package that produces jobs or not say so. So thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to have this input today.
I appreciate your coming and providing your input.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Pat Wrighton, the president of Pacific Power, and it's just a delight to be here. I want to thank you, Chairman Beyer, for participating in the Vision Committee, as well as the two senators. And I had to laugh. My good friend Senator Monroe actually referred to me as my father, Dick Wrighton, and it's a reminder that
I'm old.
It's a reminder that I seem to have fallen into what is now apparently a family tradition of wayward utility executives getting in the middle of transportation issues. So I'm not sure how that happened, but I did have the honor to serve as the governor's Transportation Vision Committee chair. And so I thought what I might do here today is describe a little bit of that process and its makeup and a little bit about the outcomes. Certainly the panelists coming after us comprise a distinguished group who will be able to, I know, add a lot of detail to those recommendations. First of all, it's important to know that ultimately the Transportation Vision Committee was comprised of, depending on the day, 30 to 40 self-selected people who represented various interests that comprised a wide range. The members of the four largest business associations in Oregon, transportation leaders from TriMet to ODOT to others, Metro, lobby organizations from the truckers to AAA to the building trades to the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, Association of Oregon Counties, chambers of commerce, community elected leaders, the environmental lobby, including the 1,000 Friends of Oregon, key legislators, and others. Notably, as was mentioned, the governor's staff participated to staff the committee, and both Chris and Hans did a fabulous job and participated to the quality of the conversation in a fairly substantial way. We began meeting on January 3rd, 2008, ultimately met virtually multiple times a month, spawned several subcommittees that met and worked straight through to this past December through the Oregon Business Summit. Those players, a knowledgeable group on transportation issues, ultimately came together, I think, because of a shared vision. The 2006 Oregon Transportation Plan laid out some of that. By 2030, freight is expected to increase 80% statewide and double in the Portland metro area. Oregon's population is expected to grow 41% in that time. Congestion on our roads is expected to increase 42% by 2025. ODOT estimated annual underinvestment in transportation of $1.3 billion. I know those are familiar statistics to you, but I think they bear repeating because the people sitting around the table at the Vision Committee were united by that sense of need and the desire to put together a package that was ultimately saleable. The other primary issue we talked a lot about was the fact that the gas tax as a funding mechanism will substantially diminish its buying power over a period of time due to inflation, due to increased fuel efficiency attainment, and conversion to other fuels, particularly electric vehicles. So, you know, as is, I think, the obvious, jobs and economic activity and quality of life all hang in the balance. So the committee also displayed a strong interest, if new investment is going to happen, in doing it right, doing it in a way from that's sustainable from an environmental, carbon, and a land use perspective. The mission of the Vision Committee comprised two major goals. One was to put together a vision statement, a vision plan, a statement of how we expect the transportation system in this state to look in 2030. I think that's been provided to you as a handout. We also were charged with putting together a set of recommendations going forward to fund and gather transportation resources into the future. You know, ultimately, a blueprint on how we get from here to there. It's important to remember that the Vision Committee comprised only one of three committees. There was a governance committee chaired by Steve Clark, as well as a public awareness committee chaired by Chip Terhune. We started off working with the governor's five key core principles in mind. Those are economic development, local decision-making, sustainability, transparency and oversight, and statewide distribution, the need for all Oregonians to benefit, which, you know, frankly resonates to us serving, I think, 30 of the state's counties. We did deliver that plan to the governor for his consideration, as he asked, and we believe that was a primary base for the development of the Transportation and Jobs Act that he's forwarded to you for consideration. Those recommendations include both transitional and traditional measures, tough but necessary near-term action to raise money through a combination of fee and gas tax increases to fund annual road and highway improvements, establishment of a dedicated multimodal fund to aid transit, rail, port improvements, as well as boosting other modes of transportation, including non-motorized, and a look to the future by moving forward the concept of a transportation utility commission, introducing lease cost planning to criteria for planning purposes, boosting the transition to electric and hybrid vehicles, as well as moving forward with vehicle miles traveled and congestion planning pilots. So you'll hear from, again, many of the participants in the committee. The group in the audience, actually, this feels a lot like a committee meeting because I think we're all here. I do, again, want to thank them for their participation, for sharing their wisdom and knowledge, and for working in good faith to come up with a strong product. I would say that this was a fairly unique experience, and I think in many ways exemplifies the way policy ought to be made in Oregon. We sat down with all the right people at one table in good faith and worked constructively together. And that, from the standpoint of a non-transportation professional, was really a delight to see. So with that, I'll stop there, but again, would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pat, I really appreciate all the work that all of your committees did. I listened in on some. I admit I didn't get to near as many as I probably should have, but they were all north of Salem.
Anyway. We knew if we held the Pacific Corps, we could guarantee free parking and available room, but you are
right. Your Public Utility Transportation Commission, mm-hmm. I have a real problem with. Mm-hmm. I know that you're familiar with Public Utility Commission, and it fits for you. For me as a legislature, I cannot at all support some group of five people setting what the gas tax is going to be.
Yeah, and I appreciate that comment. In fact, going into that recommendation, we knew that would be one of the more controversial aspects. And it probably bears saying that You know, one thing that the commission tried not to do was to do your job. We knew a lot of things were evolving outside of the room, as has been referenced, the economy. The mere price of gasoline fluctuated unbelievably during the term of our work. You know, there were ballot initiatives being considered. So we knew that some pieces of the plan would be more politically saleable than others, but we wanted to put options on the table. The idea of a transportation utility commission is very familiar to me, being part of a regulated utility, and the idea behind it is that it's difficult to cede control from the legislature standpoint, but actually having a body to figure out what the revenue requirement would be to fund transportation, not only from a capital investment standpoint, but from an operations management standpoint, view the necessary and available funding opportunities, and then actually set rates was something we thought was worthy of consideration. In the room, we knew that might be a hard sell at the legislature, but we thought it was worth recommending because going through the steps of at least figuring out what the revenue requirement is and what the available mechanisms are and what how those could be used would be worthwhile, even if the authority to make actual decisions was retained by the legislature.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a couple questions, if I may, that were prompted by our senators. First, Senator Monroe, you prompted one with me when you said you're worried about taxes getting referred back to the ballot and everything. And I think the biggest thing probably, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, that probably kills us is the legislature. And I know since I'm a newly elected official, but one of the things that prompted me to even be here today is the lack of accountability that we show with the funds and the revenue that we take in. And you almost feel like in the public that we're using their wallets as our personal ATMs to achieve some of these goals. And I'm just wondering, with this, when I've looked at this plan, it seems like a lot more bureaucracy and not a lot of money getting put into actually building more lanes and improving road systems that we have and going right to what we need to do and putting the money to work. And I'm just wondering, with this plan that we have, do you think it's going to get referred back to the voters?
Well, first of all, let me say most Oregonians are not aware of the fact that we really underfund our transportation system, that when you look at the number of dollars per automobile or per driver that we charge for all of the fees related to an automobile, that we're less than half of the state of Washington or California and even way below Idaho. So we have for years underfunded our transportation system. It's falling apart. It's an investment that we have made on behalf of the citizens of this state. We're a transportation state. We're really the transportation hub, the greater Portland area in particular. And if we can't move goods and services efficiently around this state, the state economy is going to dry up. I think we get elected, I think you got elected, because you have some judgment and some wisdom to try and meet some of these needs that the average citizen doesn't understand, and the average citizen perhaps cannot look out into the future and see what happens if we can't move freight around this state, either by truck or by rail or by barge, that if we can't access our international airport where a lot of the high-tech freight goes in and out of, if our roads and highways clog up, that the economy of this state will suffer dramatically. The average voter may not be able to perceive that, but you and I, because we have access to the information, can see that. And so I was elected to make decisions based on the best judgment I have. If I make decisions that the voters don't like, they will elect somebody else to my district, and that's fine. I've been elected, I've been unelected, I've been elected again, I've been unelected again, and I've been elected again over the last 35 years. And so I understand that's the way the process works. I know that many legislators are primarily concerned about whether they get elected in the next election or not. I'm not. So that's where I come down.
Could I respond, Madam Chair? Do you have a question for me? Because I was just going to respond to the...
It's kind of on the same lines.
Okay. I think that one of the things that I just want to be sure that I get on the record, and you and I have not even met, I don't think, so we don't really know philosophically how we stand, but I think that it's really important that people have confidence that people in positions like you and all of you on this committee and those of us here, that we are making decisions with a sensitivity to the economy and to the public and to their wallet and how we spend their money. And I think that that is uppermost important. I think what if there has been a failure, it has been the failure to communicate to the public as often as we could and should about the decisions that we've made and why we've made them. So that's all I needed to say, other than I know that I can speak for many of the people on this committee because I've worked with them, and I know their sensitivity to people's economic situations.
That actually kind of brings me the sensitivity part.
Okay.
Because when I look at this, I really have trouble supporting it when I see tripling of registration fees, things like that, because it doesn't affect the guy making $150,000 a year. It's the guy making $40,000 a year raising his two kids at home. That tripling of fees hurts him. It would be a lot easier for me to stomach like an 8 cent a gallon or 10 cent a gallon gas tax increase rather than 2 cents than making this guy come up with an extra $60-$70 at one time. So this is something I think that really is going to hurt the poor people in our districts. And right now my unemployment, I believe, is getting up at 11%, and they can't afford to go pay those fees if we do this to them.
Well, Representative Weiner, I have to declare a potential conflict of interest. My family have been in the automobile business in Oregon for the last 40 years, so I would not want to make too many comments about the registration and title fees. I have my own opinions about that. But I think that when you look at the amount that they are being increased, it certainly gives you pause.
You know, if I might jump in just for a moment, and not having ever run for elected office or having
You're smarter
elected,
than the rest of us.
Yes,
I fortunately haven't had to be in your shoes in terms of having to judge how much is too much, because I know that's a difficult question. But just a couple of metrics and then a comment. The current, based on average use, the current fees from gas tax registration and title for your average Oregon motorist is about $180 a year. The recommendations in the Transportation Vision Committee plan would increase those $75 a year. So from a percentage standpoint, that's a fairly sizable increase. From a dollar standpoint, maybe not so much, particularly compared to other states. Your comment about the gas tax I found interesting, because that was one of the conversations we had at the committee level. And in fact, if you look through the committee recommendations, there is a 2% gas tax recommendation, but there's an alternative set of recommendations in there as well, with a higher gas tax and lower fee and title increase suggestions. And I think the idea was that we would have a hard time judging the impact politically, and wanted to show what those alternatives look like. So I would commend that to you as one attempt to try and look at that balance.
Thank you. We got a lot of people who want to talk.
So. Just as a real quick follow-up, when you guys did this, I was just wondering, on the electric cars, did you look at just a flat fee? Because I know right now I pay probably about $35 a month in fuel tax, just myself, not counting my wife. And just breaking it down to an electric car pays $30 a month, or put a simple monthly fee on the electric car.
The suggestion in the recommendations was to forward. There has been a pilot for a vehicle mile traveled fee or tax, and to look to extend that further as the mechanism for non-gas fueled vehicles.
Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, I'll be very brief. I'm new to the Transportation Committee and transportation issues. I just want to take this moment to thank the three people in front of me, particularly, and all the people in back. I shudder to think where we would be if, without your year's work, walking in here and trying to put together any kind of a transportation package. So there may be puts, there may be takes, there may be things some of us like or don't, but thank goodness that you have gotten us to the point where we're talking important details instead of back where you were a year ago. So for your hard work and informing me and getting me up to speed on some of these puts and takes, thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Representative Shulkin.
Hey, thank you very much. And say hello to my senator as well while he's here, who's right around the corner. You know, I'm glad to hear that my friend from Yamhill County, and I'm sure everyone on that side of the aisle, is going to be leading the charge for an 8 to 10 cent gas and a fee on electric cars, and I can't wait to see the size of that ATM card.
Thank you, and with that, we'll get moving. But I really appreciate all your work on this and the free parking in Portland. I don't know if I have to claim that, but. And I also want to, even though he's not here, thank Steve Clark for his hard work on the Governance Committee. It was greatly appreciated. And with that, I'm going to call Craig Honeyman and Rex Burkholder forward.
Art's here, too.
So. Oh, he's back. And Art, I saw you leave, but you came back on me.
The Senate sent me back, so I could come back.
Which order would you like us in, Chair Byer?
Whatever order you want. If you've got the mic there, go ahead.
Okay.
And we're going to, you know, we have a lot of people, so.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Byer, members of the committee. My name is Craig Honeyman, Legislative Director for the League of Oregon Cities. We represent all 242 cities in Oregon, 70% of the population, and 20,000 lane miles of streets and roads in the state. Very grateful to have the opportunity to comment on the Jobs and Transportation Act. I'm passing out some extended remarks in the interest of time. I'll be brief and summarize those points. As you hear my testimony and read those comments, you'll notice some themes and points of emphasis. Those include the importance of this bill as it relates to economic recovery and job creation, the issue of local government funding shortfalls, which in prior testimony to this committee, the League pointed out that in its 2007 study amount to $160 million of delta between what is needed and what cities have in the aggregate around Oregon for just straight maintenance and preservation activities. That number is probably north of that now. The need for new and sustainable funding and the maintenance of the local decision-making process to include avoidance of preemption. You know, when this committee started over a year ago, little did we know the economic straits that this country and the state would be in. So as we did our work, I think it was the anticipation of the committee that this transportation bill would be, if not the, or at least a defining issue in this legislative session. Notwithstanding the budget difficulties you and we are all dealing with, I would suggest to you that this still will be a defining issue in the legislature this session, because indeed it's part of the state's economic recovery strategy. It will hopefully sustain the one-time federal and state stimulus programs that are being embarked upon today with long-term job-creating programs. The League was proud to be a part of the process. I had two elected officials and helped staff the Vision Committee that resulted in the report to the governor, which in turn resulted in House Bill 2120. It's comprehensive. It's visionary, it's multimodal, it's green, and it also raises badly needed new revenues for our transportation system. I'm pleased to report to you today that the League of Oregon City substantially supports House Bill 2120. And that is due to the fact that it positively addresses most of the principles underlying the League's transportation priority for this session. The $499 million that it raises, $91 million of which is due to come to cities for road preservation and maintenance, is a good start. And as we were just discussing, I know there's angst about how to raise those funds between fees and taxes. And the League is prepared and would like to participate in those discussions as we determine the best mix of revenue opportunities. We're looking for sustainability not only in terms of the greenness of the package, but also the economics, the funding of the package. And we hope that whatever is decided here, that it's not another 16 years before the legislature is able to effectively address revenue issues as it relates to streets and roads in our state. To that end, we're also interested in participating in the discussion of alternative revenue options to generate revenues for the state for the state's transportation system, particularly in light of the declining gas tax situation. Also, opportunities to provide for demand management opportunities. We're very strongly in support of the 50-30-20 state, county, city funding formula that is contained in the bill. That is a key component of our priority strategy. We're pleased that one of the five underlying principles of the report and the bill that comes before you stresses the importance of local control. We would expand that to include no preemption. That's one of the fundamental principles of this proposal, and we are pleased about that. It funds urban and rural transit, funds green and multimodal system enhancements, and has the support of a diverse transportation community, most of whom are seated behind us. If there is a concern, and it's just been raised, the League of Oregon City shares the concern about the Transportation Utility Commission. We have concerns about the additional regulatory structure that is imposed or implied by this commission over an already very complex transportation bureaucracy that informs and manages transportation policy in this state. If a TUC is created, it should not be allowed to preempt local governments from addressing their own transportation needs and being able to contribute to solutions going forward. We're also not sure about a process where the agency is created and then is asked to basically justify its own feasibility and its own role in transportation policy going forward as it reports back to the next session. In short, please think long and hard before transferring accountability and autonomy away from existing entities to a Transportation Utility Commission. If I could, Madam Chair, I'd like to briefly address a proposal that was put before you in testimony earlier this week by the Oregon Petroleum Association. First of all, we appreciate their acknowledgement of local transportation funding challenges, and we are aware of how lucrative this proposal might be, at least in the short term. However, we are not likely to support such a proposal for several reasons. First of all, the cap on future local gas taxes violates our policy with regard to preemption. It violates the 50-30-20 partnership that we have with the state transportation department and with our friends from the counties. It's not sustainable, in fact, in terms of matching future transportation costs. It's not indexed, and it ties cities to what I think most people believe is a slowly dying source of revenue. We're not sure where the proposal leads cities in terms of access to other shared transportation revenues through title fees, registrations, et cetera. And to bring up the subject of referral, we can be assured all day long about the fact that this proposal would not be referred, but there are no assurances at the end of the day that that could be accomplished, and frankly, that is not a politically comfortable political limb for cities or for local governments to be out on all by themselves. Local gas taxes we submit are a viable method of supporting local transportation budgets. It involves local accountability and decision-making. It's a tool to fund ongoing transportation projects, especially as a tool to support specific projects where the tax could be sunsetted, and it spreads the cost between residents as well as and visitors. In conclusion, I also want to thank this committee for agreeing last Friday to introduce, at the request of the League of Oregon Cities, an LC draft relative to the Special City Allotment Program, that program which funds cities under 5,000, their transportation needs. I look forward to the opportunity to explain in greater detail what's intended by that legislation, either as an amendment to this bill or as a standalone measure at whatever serves the chair and the committee's pleasure. Thank you for inviting this testimony. I want to congratulate the ODOT staff, the governor's staff, and the governor himself for bringing this to you and for the leadership that kept this process on track and productive throughout. We look forward to working with all the stakeholders to make sure that House Bill 2120 contributes to future transportation needs and to the economic growth of this state. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and committee. My name is Rex Burkholder. I'm a Metro Councilor. I've represented my district for the last 8 years, which includes most of the city of Portland. And then the last 4 years, I've served as chair of the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, which is the local elected officials in the Portland metropolitan area that deal with the issue of transportation. And I'm here today speaking on behalf of that group. And I have brought you some materials here, as well as I sat on the Transportation Vision Committee and helped draft what's in front of you today. We have a resolution that's part of the package we passed out to you, and it includes on the second page an attachment, which this was actually adopted early 2008, before the year's worth of work on the transportation vision, yet much of the ideas in here are included as well. And so it's a good summary, the idea of taking care of what we have, the idea of looking at maintaining funding distribution, looking at how can we make decisions that are at the least cost in terms of investments, expanding local options, et cetera. But that's there for you to look into. But it's very similar. And then also let you know that the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation and the Metro Council both endorsed House Bill 2120 as well. And why did we do that? Well, we strongly support increased revenues to both repair and maintain our existing transportation investments. And I think one of the key issues is there has not been a gas tax increase since 1993, either on the state or the federal level. That's one of the key problems that we're facing, is that we're trying to deal with the amount of money that we had 16 years ago and do more, because we've had quite a bit of population growth, quite a bit of new facilities put in place that need to be maintained. But I'm going to not go into too much detail here, but I want to kind of stay on this level, because that's the level that I think we'll have plenty of comments on the details, but on the top level, on the aerial view, that's what I want to give you. And one of the things that we're struggling with right now in the metro area is that recognizing the world has changed. I mentioned the fiscal issues, the fact that dollars coming in, the revenues coming in aren't matching needs. That's just one. Another one is that we have this economic and financial crisis going on throughout the economy, which means we have to be a lot smarter in what kind of investments we make, and we have to look at those investments and see what they leverage. Not just have we fixed a road, but has that project to fix that road actually led to increased economic prosperity as well. Energy is a key issue. Right now the prices are down, but we know as oil becomes more and more scarce and we have more turmoil in other parts of the world, we know the price of energy will be going up. So we need to think about how do we create a transportation system that isn't so reliant on petroleum and that can protect our citizens from those kind of price shocks. We have a growing population. Despite everything that's going on in the world today, our population growth rates in the Portland metro area are staying at some of the highest rates in the whole country. It's still a great place to live, and everybody knows about it now. The other issue is climate change, which if we think about the one aspect, is that it will lead to increase in energy costs, because the ways of dealing with reducing carbon dioxide emissions is by making carbon more expensive. And that's where our petroleum comes from, is carbon intensive, and it's 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions in this state, so we know that will have impacts on us. In addition, we want to be responsible stewards for the future, and so therefore we want to look at how do we provide good mobility, good access to our population without creating other problems, and climate change being one of those. So I want to thank Mr. Wrighton here and the others in the audience that worked on that Transportation Vision Committee. It's not easy trying to cope with these big issues and trying to come up with creative, innovative ideas on how to address them in ways when we know we have all these limitations and we have all these constraints. A couple key issues that I really want to focus on here. One is that we need to look at our metropolitan areas and look at it more closely. Over 60% of our state's population lives in the six metropolitan regions. That includes Bend, the Medford area, Eugene-Springfield, Salem-Keizer, and Corvallis is also considered a metropolitan area by the federal government, and the Portland metro area. Over 60% of the population and probably 75% of the state's economic output comes from those metropolitan areas. Yet what we have is a system, because it relies so much on the gas tax, that the investments go basically into highways. And a good example is the proposal in front of us, in front of the Oregon Transportation Commission, on how to spend the money from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Right now, we look at that bill or that proposal that's there. Only 15% of those dollars are coming to the Portland metro area, even though we're 45% of the population, and typically we get 38% of the state's transportation funding. And it's ahead. The focus on highways is that more than 80% of the funding approved last week by the Oregon Transportation Commission are highway projects. Well, in the metropolitan areas, we need to look at how do we invest in multimodalism. And just to give you an example, the Washington State transportation and investment in the stimulus includes $108 million for improving or buying new train sets for the Cascade run on Amtrak. So there's another example there of another state that's saying, how do we face these problems? How do we invest our dollars and start looking into transportation alternatives? In the metropolitan areas, this is a critical strategy for going forward. It's very important for us to look at using technology in terms of making the traffic flow better, to ensure freight mobility, to look at issues of tolling, congestion pricing, various demand management tools we need to have, and then also we have to provide people with the alternatives. It's no good saying, okay, we're going to make it more expensive to drive your car or harder to drive your car, and that's your only choice. We have to look at giving people other options. I chaired the Visions Committee subcommittee on multimodal transportation. The package that's in front of you today includes some of our recommendations. And one key one there was looking at towards the federal government, where 20% of the federal transportation budget goes to transit, 80% goes to highways. We said, let's aim for that as a target. Let's start saying that Oregon should have an investment in its transportation system that's balanced, and we need to look at revenue going in there at that level. That didn't quite get there. There's a piece here that's really important that shouldn't be lost. It's a step in that right direction, and that is, if this bill passes, dedicating the flexible dollars that we get from the federal government, which is about $44 million a year now, and dedicating that to alternative transportation, transit, biking, walking, other forms. And those dollars actually can be spent off the highway system, and that's pretty rare money because all our state gas tax have to be spent on the highway system. So I think that's a real critical. It's Section 15, and we're very strongly in supporting that. Then there's the new tools, and I'll wrap up here. It's really important, and I know there's going to be some concerns about issues like a transportation utility commission. I think we need to look at these things in terms of the current system is not good enough for the future. Not today, it's breaking down, is not good enough for the future. Here's one idea. Maybe it's not the right idea, maybe it's not the best idea, but it is a way forward, a way to start thinking about these issues. The least cost planning, very similar to work we've done in the metro area in terms of doing scenarios, of looking at the variety of different investments we might make and which ones give us the best return on that money that we invest. And it's difficult. It's because we'd like to do the old way because we know how to do it. But that's not working anymore. We have to figure out new ways of doing things. And finally, we do need new funding. And I want to reiterate that again. As you've heard before, we pay, as it turns to the government in terms of taking care of our transportation system, we pay a small fraction of the cost of transportation. The AAA estimates that it's $10,000 a year per car to own a car, operate a car. Of that, it's a few hundred dollars that actually goes to help pay for maintaining the system we drive on every day. And we need to look at that in that context. The other piece is we need to give people options so they don't have to spend that $10,000 a year so they can get their needs met in other ways, or at least reduce their reliance on that. So, again, you have more details on here from the resolution that our organization's passed, and I encourage you to move ahead on this and do the hard work to help us out here in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Art.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Art Slock, and I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties.
I had the pleasure of, this almost looks like a reunion here, and I'm working on a 50th high school reunion, so this is a reunion from people I spent a lot of time with in the last year. I had the pleasure of participating in the Governance Committee, the Vision Committee, and the Revenue Subcommittee. So, as you can tell, and also the other committee that was mentioned dealing with public involvement and notice. So, had lots of opportunities. I want to thank the governor for this comprehensive look at transportation funding. It's the first time, I think, in my experiences at the legislature where we've brought together a variety of interests to look at transportation and transportation funding, not just the automobile, but other modes at this point. Certainly the participation by you, Representative Beyer, Senator Monroe, and Senator Verger provide a kind of a settling effect on a lot of the discussions that we had, a reality check, if you will. So that, at least, I want to mention, was greatly appreciated. The Association of Oregon Counties supports a transportation funding package, the passage of that this session. It is essential that you, members of the Transportation House Committee, look very long and hard at this and recommend that we go forward with a funding package this session. The need for a funding package is well documented. I don't want to spend time. I've spent time talking to many of you about the fiscal situation that counties currently find themselves in with regard to transportation and transportation funding. This package, if you embrace it, at $500 million annually, would generate, at with 50-30-20, about $136 million annually for counties at 30%. Whether you go a little bit higher or a little bit lower, but at $500 million, $136 million. It's important to note that the counties are going to lose $100 million, not next year, not the year after, but 3 years down the road with the loss of federal forest monies. The counties that get money out of the federal forest timber fund will lose approximately $100 million. So the difference between 136 and the 100 that they're going to lose, at this point, it's not adding a whole lot to the pot, but it is significant that we're not going to lose as much as we would otherwise at this point. And so I think it's important that at least you take that in consideration. The backbone of this package still is the interconnected system of state highways, county roads, and city streets. And that, I would submit to you, is the backbone of the transportation system. Without that, the other modes would have a very difficult time meeting their needs and the functions, whether it's transit that uses the roads, whether it's people getting to in the transit systems like light rail and other kinds of things, pedestrians and the like. So it is appropriate that a major portion of this funding package be directed towards the road system within the state, which has been neglected, I would submit, for a long time, and we have a lot to do in terms of maintenance and preservation. From the county's perspective, there are certain sections of this bill that are, I'll say, essential, that we would hate to see lost or changed in any great detail. Section 38, dealing with the 50-30-20 allocation of funds at this point. Counties support 50-30-20. The sooner we can get there, I think the better off that we will have balanced funding for the highway system that is shared by the state, the counties, and the cities. Sections 39 and 46 would call to your attention. This deals with what we call the special county fund, or it's referred to in the bill as the forest allocation at this point. This is a realization that there are a number of counties, especially in eastern Oregon and maybe in southern Oregon, that have large road systems and very small populations, but they are essential to the interconnected system of roads that we look to. Those need to have the doors open. And the $4,500 a mile or $1 million, whichever is greater, is kind of the minimum funding that we've all agreed to that is necessary to keep the county road departments functioning at this point. These sections would provide for a sharing between Oregon Department of Transportation and counties to provide that minimum level of funding. Currently, there are four or five counties that currently get money out of that account. And with the federal forest funds going away in the next couple of years, it could be up to 12 to 14 counties that will then fall within that. So those sections are extremely important to ensure that we continue to have functioning county road departments. Then I would call your attention to sections 51 and 57. This deals with the local vehicle registration fee, or vehicle registration fees, and being able to adopt those without what I've referred to and you've heard me say is double jeopardy, where you go to a vote prior to enacting an ordinance, and then that once you adopt an ordinance, it can be referred back to the voters for a second bite of the apple at this point. We need to provide an opportunity for local governments to try and help themselves. And even if you were to, well, even with this provision passing, there are only a few counties that will probably go forward with a local vehicle registration fee, and I would just submit also that part of that will depend upon what the legislature does with the statewide fee. I mean, there's only so much you can put on any one kind of fee at this point, and certainly it's an option that we very much would like to see in the toolbox at this point. So we hope that you will continue to have those sections within the bill. Just a couple of comments real briefly. The whole idea of least cost planning, I would submit to you this is not new. And in fact, we have the tools available for us to basically do that today. And the tool is the transportation system plans, which is the marriage of transportation and land use that we currently do. It's just that we don't, right now we do not utilize that tool to actually look at a variety of alternatives to meet the transportation needs of a jurisdiction. As part of that, we primarily look at the road system and how the road system is necessary to implement the land use without looking at other alternatives, and we could do that. But finally, Madam Chair, and I know you're going to run out of I'm out of time at this point. Finally, I would just like to echo, I guess, a concern about the Transportation Utility Commission. There are a number of questions that have not been answered, and I think needs to be addressed and before the legislature goes forward with that. And with that, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you. And unless, okay.
Briefly, Madam Chair. Mr. Honeyman, I agree we have to maintain our partnership and make sure that we don't shortchange cities and local governments. And Mr. Slack, I think the conversation has to quit. We have to get off the continuing our timber payments and get on to talking about getting us back on federal land. And I don't know if we can ever fill that hole, but we can use that fiber to for innovative fuel sources that are more environmentally friendly. And I support things like increasing the bike and path 1% up to 1.5% alternatives, but I'm not going to support anything that gets in the way of improving and making it easier to move freight from south of Wilsonville to north of Vancouver that's going over our brand-new 12-lane bridge. So I just wanted to share that with you, Councillor. Thank you for coming.
Representative Call.
I'm not going to comment on Representative Schaffler's comments. I just wanted to say, Art, I'm glad to hear you say that there are mechanisms already out there marrying the the problems of land use and the comprehensive plan there and the problems of transportation together, I think that that's going to be a source of some contention. But I think it should be pointed out, and rightfully so by you, that we already have the capacity to look at those things together and probably should. And I just wanted to tell you how much I appreciated those comments.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. And
thank you.
We'll move on. Fred Hansen, Marion Hayes, and Duncan Weiss. John Ledger, do you want to join him up here? Or?
Poor Fred.
Marion?
How did Fred get associated with this group?
I know, I'm wondering.
So, I'm going to drag a chair up and we'll get going. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Fred Hansen, General Manager of TriMet. I really do want to compliment, you've heard it echoed before, but the process, what Pat Wrighton really led, but the whole of the group was very, very important, and people that are here were a part of that as well. Second, I think it's really important that the group really did understand and kept in place a sense that we had to have balance in the package, and that is was very important, that all modes needed be addressed. There also, I believe, in the Vision Committee, a real recognition that transit, and particularly the TriMet system that I head up, is able to leverage substantial amounts of federal dollars that are discretionarily distributed. These are dollars that, if they didn't come to Oregon, they would go to Salt Lake City or Denver or Atlanta or some other place. Those dollars have been approximately over $1 billion since we've been investing in the light rail projects for our region. And that has produced thousands of jobs for Oregonians, obviously particularly of concern at this stage. But the issue that's around those discretionary dollars is that to be able to compete for them successfully, we must, in fact, show three things, the so-called three-legged stool. One is great projects. Two, that we have the ability to be able to have the federal or the match, the local dollars, to be able to match the federal dollars, generally in the 40-60% split. And then lastly, that we must be able to operate the system. It is clearly makes sense that the federal government doesn't want to participate in building something that then can't be operated. And so we must show 20 years worth of operating revenue. This legislation that's before you, the bill, does provide for additional transit funding that allows us to be able to have that third leg of the stool be able to be shown. And as a result, absolutely critical for us to be able to get discretionary funding for this region, for this state. Thank you.
Thank you. Marion.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Marion Haynes. I'm with the Oregon Business Association. OBA participated in the Governor's Vision Committee and strongly supports passage of a transportation package this session. Would like to thank the Governor for pulling together this group and his staff, Hans and Chris, who did a great job on this, as well as Pat Wrighton for leading the Vision Committee. The longer we wait to address our longstanding transportation needs, the more it will cost us. Mr. Wrighton talked a little bit about the population and freight growth that we're expecting and the needs of the system. What we did a number of years ago, members of the business community, along with ODOT, is commission a study that looked at the economic impact of failure to address those needs. More than 400,000 Oregon jobs, or one in five, are transportation-related or transportation-reliant. And businesses around the state are already feeling the impacts of inadequate investment in the system. We interviewed a number of companies throughout the state, and while the issues that they face may be different, congestion in the Portland area, a lack of viable alternatives in some of the more rural areas of the state, if there's a road closure for some reason, the impacts are felt statewide. Intel, Les Schwab, Fred Meyer, Georgia Pacific, Roseburg Forest Products, they all talked about being impacted by the transportation system and the need for more investment. In that analysis, we learned that failing to adequately invest in the transportation system may cost Oregon's economy $1.7 billion annually and 16,000 permanent jobs by 2025. As well as significant numbers of short-term construction jobs. We think this should be viewed as unacceptable. The Vision Committee brought together a broad and diverse group of stakeholders to develop a package that addresses the variety of transportation needs and impacts around the state, the need to move goods reliably and efficiently, the need to provide transportation options for both people and freight, the need to address the impacts of the transportation system on our climate. All of these issues were considered and taken into account in the Vision Committee recommendations that form the basis of the Jobs and Transportation package in front of you. We think that the recommendations represent the collective work of this broad and diverse committee, and it's a good place to start the discussion about shaping a package. We recognize that there will be modifications as the legislature works on this and commit to working with you with the hope of maintaining the balanced approach that was struck. Taking action now can not only help ensure the state does not suffer the kind of long-term economic losses I talked about earlier, it will also provide a short-term boost by creating jobs at a time when we so desperately need them. Particularly with funds from the OTIA program beginning to decline in the near term, this is really a matter of not just increasing jobs, but ensuring that we don't have losses from those investments drying up at this point. We recognize this is a really difficult time to generate additional revenues, but we view this as an investment from which we will reap returns in the form of job creation, long-term economic benefit, and quality of life. Thank you.
Thank you.
Duncan. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Duncan Wise. I'm with the Oregon Business Council, and I, too, participated in the Vision Committee with my colleagues in the business community and a diverse group of other Oregon leaders. I want to congratulate first the governor for calling us and bringing us together and for presenting the package to you. It's really important. I agree with Marion and all that it's really important that you take this on this session and come up with a funding package. I think there's great unity in the business community on this, as you will hear. This has been a big priority across a wide variety of business interests because of its importance to the future of the economy. I do have a handout we presented for the Oregon as part of the Oregon Business Plan. And what we did is we participated in the Vision Committee. Pat Wrighton, of course, and Steve Clark carried that work to the business plan. And you'll see that in many ways the business plan recommendations parallel what you see in the Vision Committee report. I'd like to just hit on a couple points. Marion just beautifully highlighted the need for a funding package. It's been 16 years since we've had a gas tax increase. It's a crisis. The system is deteriorating, and Marion, she's humble. She actually led that report. She just talked about the congestion study. A lot of us came together, and we documented throughout the state the need for improvements in transportation if we're going to keep this economy moving over the next 20 years. It's a crisis. It's a slow-moving crisis because, each pothole, gradually develops, but over time, it will really come back to haunt us if we don't act this session on a transportation package. But beyond that, and I think this is really important, when we sat down under Pat Wrighton's incredibly great leadership, we talked about the future of transportation in the 21st century. And what was most remarkable to me was the great consensus in that room that we are in a point of dramatic change. Over the next 20 years, we're going to go through change in transportation, not unlike what we went through in the first part of the 20th century or mid-century when we invented the interstate highway system. Over the next 20 years, we are going to go off gasoline. We are not going to be driving gasoline cars 20 years from now. We're going to be on electric fuel cell and other hybrid kinds of vehicles. We will have a tremendous change. 20 years from now, we are going to be using technology in ways we can't even dream of right now in terms of how we pay for the transportation, but also how we use that technology to navigate us through the transportation system. Those are major system changes. We're going to have a different mix of vehicle types that we're going through. We're not quite sure what it'll look like, but we are in a period of dramatic and transformational change in our transportation. We need to appreciate that. And over the next 20 years, we are going to rely on a different mix of transit and vehicle types, and we're going to have a better understanding of the connection between land use and transportation. We're going to do that a lot better. So those are all changes that are coming. One thing that probably will not change is we are going to have roads to pay for in the next 20 years, and we're going to have to continue to invest in that physical infrastructure to keep it moving, and we're going to have to find a new way to pay for it. And so the vision document before you and the bill really speaks to those changes and the vision that we have for the future. Now, which brings me to the one point, I guess, with some trepidation I would like to raise, which is about the Transportation Utility Commission. Now, I happen to think it's a great idea, although Representative Gilman, although I I concede the point you're making in terms of ultimate responsibility, but let me just briefly explain why I think it's an important idea, and I was thrilled that the committee adopted it, at least to bring to you. And I would just pledge to you that there's a group of us who really believe in this and would love to work with you. It's an eclectic group, but I believe it actually could be one of the most important things you do if you get this launched. The reality is that governance in transportation is about 100 years old. Cities, counties, state, the different jurisdictions, it's an old system, and the way we pay for the transportation system is really jerry-rigged in a lot of ways. We rely on a combination of local fees. Property taxes used to pay a large part of it. That was limited with the Measure 5. Timber receipts paid for traditionally. That's been limited now. The gas tax is a big piece of it, but the gas tax is going away because you're not going to be relying on gasoline. We've got to rethink this system. The other part is that the system is blurred. I mean, the city, county, state distinction was meaningful at one time. Increasingly, as you look at those roads, they're all one big, blurry set of roads serving a variety of needs across jurisdictions. Those jurisdictional boundaries don't necessarily make a lot of sense. And as you look at the revenue creation in these systems, we don't have a common way of understanding the city, county, and state needs at one time on a regular basis to figure out what the total transportation needs and the revenue requirement needs are for the system. So what would this commission do? It would step back and take a fundamental look at the system in its totality, city, county, state. It would look at the system revenue requirements, looking at the maintenance costs, the preservation costs, the capital costs, how was it cost to run the system, and it would come up with a common set of charts and accounts so you could look at the system across cities, counties, understand how they're performing, where the needs are, what the performance is, and it would propose to you a rate design. How are we going to pay for this system? What is the mix of city, county, state fees? What's the revenue design going to be? What's the underlying theory? I will tell you there is not a clear theory anymore, given the way this has evolved over time. It would take, in short, a fresh look at what is it going to take to deliver a world-class transportation system in the 21st century. We need to do this. Whether you ultimately give that commission authority to set the rates, like I think there's a logic for, just like you let the PUC set the energy rates, that you don't have to decide today or this session. But you can, this session, set up the process to get that information, which I will tell you, you need regardless. Whatever happens, you need this information. And so if you set that up, I think by the time you come back next session, you can then get into the next level of governance of what you want to do with this information. But I can almost promise you, if you have the information, you'll be really happy and you'll be glad you did. So I would encourage you, I'd love to work with you on this. Again, it's part, I think, of the whole vision committee work that recognizes we are in a period of transition and we need to think about what it's going to take to make this transition. I would argue it's part of the package. So with that, but again, in summary, we think it's really important to address the critical short-term needs in transportation, to pass the transportation package. We think you should keep your eye on the fact that we're in a period of transition, and you have the opportunity to lead the transportation transformation. I would finally close. Oregon was the first state to adopt a gas tax. We can be the first state to move into the new world of paying in a new and different way, and I think you can lead that effort. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ledger.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. We're very interested in this issue. We have about 1,600 members. About 300 are manufacturers. And oddly enough, congestion, the tolerance for congestion is much higher among the general public than it is among business. I think because with business it's focused on the bottom line. And you can go to places like Los Angeles where the congestion is just amazing. Even at 2 in the morning, the freeways are slow, and people tolerate it. They don't like it, they hate it, but they tolerate it. And so that's, I think, one of the reasons you're hearing a lot from business on this, as the effects are felt by business first and focused. And I think that's why there are concerns about something getting referred or coming to the ballot, and that the public's tolerance is surprisingly high. So the package, I think, needs to be something that is attractive to the public on its face. I'm not going to go through all the details. You've been hearing a lot of details on this. I was on the Vision Committee, as just was about everybody, and best I could tell, it's kind of like people that were related to people came across on the Mayflower, you know, it's thousands. One of the things that occurred in that committee that was good and that you're seeing that might be a little confusing is the committee functioned very well. It was very amiable. People came up with a lot of ideas, and there was almost no veto of any ideas. People would go, okay, you know, I may not like that, but let's put it in there for something for the legislature to consider. So one of the value things of the report is it has a whole lot of things in there that were ideas that are technically have merit, but they may not politically have merit. And this is something that is, of course, as you know, just as a normal part of the legislative process, is some have already been lopped off. You know, it's already lost some appendages. And you guys will go through the normal process of devising something that will come through. And, all those details will get taken care of. We feel it's very important, however, that this bill be significant, a significant size. Because it seems, and I have no idea why this is, but it seems like opportunities for something like this come along like every 10 years, every 7 years. There's sort of a time when it's ripe. And I think this may be a time when it's ripe. So we would encourage you to make it as significant, as large a piece as you can. And I think there's also some, when something is large enough, it takes on other connotations. It becomes important to pass. You know, Lenin said, quantity has a quality all its own. And I think this is something you could apply here. One of the important pieces to us here is freight, especially, and the legislature has been very good at this last couple of sessions, is merging different modes of transportation. The short lines need a lot of work. Rail is environmentally good, and it's really, once you get short line rails, you can start expanding industry into places that really need it. So I think the legislature's done a great job on that. I expect it will continue. There are a lot of benefits to this, and as you go through, you're going to see one of the things that have really changed. I think people used to pass transportation bills because they wanted people to get from A to B, faster, cheaper. And what you will see now is a transportation bill is a bill that brings all sorts of values of society to the plate. Greenhouse gas, livability, land use. So it's really changed in how you look at it. And I would just urge you, I mean, something we would certainly like to see, and I'm sorry Representative Schaffler's not here, is we would like to see a lot of emphasis put on modernization. Things like 12 lanes, bridges, 12 lanes in each direction would be good. And things that help relieve the congestion. And we think that also makes it more acceptable to the average Oregonian who wants to know I can get from A to B without getting caught up in traffic and my spouse is safe when they do that. So that's all I have. We encourage you to work on this, and we'll help in any way we can.
Thank you, Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For any of the folks who represent the business community, I'm just curious, when a business chooses to make an investment, whether that's an existing business or a business choosing to move, over what time horizon do they look to make that investment generally?
I think you're seeing businesses make decisions in shorter and shorter time frames, particularly when economic development folks are working to recruit new businesses. What used to be a two-year timeline to make an evaluation is now moving more into the order of 6 months or so. So decisions are becoming much more compressed.
And I would mention it's largely dependent on the size and sophistication of what they are doing. If it's going to be a manufacturing operation, that is just because the consequences of that move are so huge on things like transportation, you know, then you could be looking at years. You know, if it's not, it's much easier and quicker.
I'm not sure I'm following. Is the question about what time frame do they look at in terms of for their planning purposes, or how fast do they move in terms of making a decision?
For the horizon at which they look for their planning purposes.
Yeah, I've talked with members who are looking at investment decisions with an eye towards whether the I-5 corridor is going to be usable and whether to be on the I-5 corridor versus inland. And, I mean, those kinds of decisions are getting made with an understanding. Basic overall perspective is the transportation infrastructure in this state adequate. And those decisions get made.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
So I would imagine then that if that's the case, that if, as you say, there are some complex decisions, especially around large facilities and they're looking out into the future, that, Mr. Wise, your description of a future in which we have potentially a lot of unknowns and potentially a lot of change, is one in which we would want to be able to deliver some certainty about future variability back to today in terms of investment decisions. Is that correct?
That would be correct.
If the chair will indulge a comment, I think Mr. Wise, your description of the Transportation Utility Commission was very cogent and persuasive, and it seems to me that it is useful as we think about our transportation and the investments that we're going to make to be able to deliver some degree of certainty back to today about that our state will have the ability to manage our system and those investments out into the future to be able to bring that into the decision calculus that's being made today. So I salute it, and I think it's very innovative.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. Appreciate it. And,
yeah.
That wasn't lost. Mike Salzgiver, Bob Shiprack, and Mel Sears.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair Beyer and committee. My name is Mel Sears. I'm a professional engineer in private practice and work for a firm called Parametrics. I'm also the past president of the American Council of Engineering Companies of Oregon, which goes by the acronym ACEC, but we're more affectionately known as the engineers. We're the folks that partner with the public sector, both at the city, county, and state level, to design many, 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 many of the projects that you see being constructed out there. Our organization represents about 120 private engineering consulting firms, or about 4,000 working Oregonians. I had the pleasure of also being on the Vision Committee because I don't think anyone wanted to be left out. It was very powerful. The debate, the conversation was extremely powerful. It was very interesting for me to hear the various stakeholders and different perspectives on these topics, so I thought it was an excellent process. And I give Pat Wrighton and Hans Bernard kudos for their cat-herding abilities to be able to deal with 30 and 40 viewpoints at any one time. I do a lot of traveling to other states and involved with transportation professionals in other states, and it's always refreshing to come home to Oregon because Oregon has a national reputation for being able to balance economic development, freight mobility, people mobility, and land use in a cohesive package that a lot of other states cannot get right. And I'm proud of the proposal put forward because I believe it carries those themes forward. And I'm here in support, obviously, of House Bill 2120 and our organization's support of that. I have four specific points on House Bill 2120 as it relates to our organization. The first point is creation of jobs. Our organizations have experienced the OTIA projects over the last several years, and I'm here to tell you that it absolutely created, sustained jobs for Oregonians, and our organizations definitely were benefiters of that. So it actually works. Transportation funding and creation of jobs actually works. The second thing is we partner a significant amount with the Oregon Department of Transportation, who uses the services of our firms to design the projects and get them built. Right now, our partnership with ODOT has never been stronger. We spend an awful lot of time partnering with them in various work groups. We have strategized with them on how to learn together, how to meld the private sector and the public sector for the benefit of Oregonians, and we're very proud of the place that we're at with our partners, ODOT. We've also, third point, very specifically did a lessons learned on the OTIA projects and said what would we do differently going forward with different transportation funding source. And it was a very valuable experience to be able to share with each other what we liked about what we did and what we didn't like so much about what we did, so that we will benefit going forward in this next package. Particularly, there was a lot of value in the environmental permitting and streamlining efforts that were put forth in OTIA. And also, we took a very hard look at program management services and what we would do differently going in the future. And my last point is ACEC is ready to engage. Our firms have staffed up to meet the needs of OTIA, and we are ready to meet the needs of House Bill 2120. We're in a little bit of an awkward situation where we have staffed up to meet the needs over the past few years, and of course we're all facing certain economic crisis, and for those of our firms that have some of the eggs in the residential basket, times are tough, and folks are figuring out ways to keep their staff engaged and employed, and sources like House Bill 2120 would be an opportunity to keep that workforce that has been created to deliver to be able to deliver the next program also. So with that, that's the end.
Thank you. Mr. Shiprock.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bob Shiprock, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council. I'm not going to talk about some of the details of this bill because I appreciate the fact that you're calling this a jobs and transportation plan, and I want to talk about the jobs part of this bill. First of all, we'd like the amount that there. I hope we can keep it at $500 million a year. I'd also like the diversity of the plan, but that's been talked about enough. Let's talk about the construction jobs that would be provided here, and I'm going to give you a little flavor of what we're looking at in the trades ourselves. And Mel, as Mel said, when his people start laying off, we're right behind them, and that's what's happening out there in the real world right now. Design firms, in fact, one major one went out of business here a couple weeks ago in Portland. There's also a spinoff effect. It's not just the construction workers. You can get a number of varying viewpoints depending on which government agency you talk about, which spinoff. I've heard anything from 9 jobs per $1 million to up to over 20. I know TriMet has some good numbers on their transit stuff. On the way down this morning, I wanted to give you a flavor of what my folks are looking at. The cement masons, these are statewide numbers. These are people actually on the out-of-work list, not people that are missing a few days or working part-time. They have been laid off. The cement masons are at 17% unemployment. Pete Savage with the carpenters yesterday told me they're at 25% unemployed. The iron workers are doing fairly well, about 10% of their journeymen, and they're doing well because of a massive job at Intel and a lot of wind turbines going up in eastern Oregon. However, Kevin Jensen told me, he says, my real problem is my apprentices. If I had my apprentices in there, I'm well over 15%. As we ramped up, as Mel's folks did, we ramped up our apprentices in order to meet the demand for construction workers with the OTIA 3 project. We're now beginning to lose those young people because they don't have a work, so they're moving into other professions. The laborers, Local 320, which represents the highway construction laborers in Oregon, just passed 20% unemployment. A couple weeks ago, they're at about 22%. The last thing I'll state is I always take a lot of pride in the skills and abilities of Oregon's construction workforce. There was a Federal Highway Administration study done a few years back that pointed out that just the productivity of our workforce in this state points out that we're in the top 5 in delivering cost-effective projects to the taxpayers. We're really good, and if you live along the light rail routes, you'll see what I'm talking about. So that's what I wanted to say. I told my folks in December I predicted a 33% unemployment rate by May, and we're well on our way to that. I didn't talk about some of the building trades, the guys that do the building work. Some of them are now approaching 50%, and this, just for your benefit, it's ugly out there, and we're not going to have a lot of contractors maybe either, but I'll hand that off to my friend Mike.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, with that, I'll take your question. No, you have written testimony from us. For the record, Mike Salzgiver, I'm Executive Director of Associated General Contractors for the Oregon Columbia Chapter, which includes all of Oregon and roughly 5.5 counties in southwest Washington. We also were a part of the governor's visioning committee. Our commendations go broad and deep to that effort, the governor himself for having the vision himself to bring it forward. The governor's staff, Hans and Chris, were tremendous in supporting it. My dear friend, Pat Wrighton, with whom I've worked now for over 25 years in a variety of capacities, Mel used the phrase herding cats. I would equate it more toward pushing a wheelbarrow full of frogs. He did a good job in keeping them mostly in the wheelbarrow. You've sat a lot today and listened to a lot of things that I would associate myself with, but I want to take a slightly different tack than you might expect AGC to take. Bob has laid out very well the unemployment situation, which is frankly, from a testimony standpoint, would be low-hanging fruit for us to start throwing those numbers out at you. They are real. Our members are feeling this literally every hour of every day, and it's getting worse. But I also want you to understand that we are taking a long-term view, and that's what I want to talk about today. We support a transportation investment package that is significant in size and strategic in nature. And what I want to talk about more today is somewhat outside the committee's jurisdiction, perhaps, but I think as you're building a package and can think about these other elements, it will be important. This package also, we believe, has to look at other infrastructure investments beyond the transportation system. So water, wastewater, the telecommunication system, things that would be considered transportation by some, but those road access projects that make a project successful or not, building on our industrial land capacity, all of those go into the economic fabric of the state, building our schools out and making them 21st century ready, and having them built in the context of the sustainable design and construction that we are embedding here in Oregon around the state. Perhaps most important part of this infrastructure package really is the workforce side. Bob alluded to it. But we are going to see in the next 10 years or so, roughly half of our workforce retire as the baby boomers begin to move along. And we need to reemploy and train the next generations of workers. And so down the road, the legislature has got to deal with this in the context of a broader infrastructure package. You've heard a lot about concerns about what the voters will bear, what taxpayers will bear. At the end of the day, we strongly believe that this package has to concentrate on long-term funding strategies and not just short-term spending strategies. Bonding, for example, has its place, but the capacity of the state to continue bonding at the rate we have over the last few years is rapidly being depleted, and we cannot sacrifice all of our available revenue to pay future debt service. So we want to talk with you about that as this unfolds. Finally, we focusing on a more topical issue for us is the need to help ODOT manage its projects well. Outsourcing design works in this state because we have excellent private design companies in Oregon and around the region that can help with that. Outsourcing project management, however, does not work very well, as we have learned with the OTIA projects, since it involves mostly shifting risk and accountability and does not necessarily save the taxpayers' money, and it's not necessarily an efficient way to do it. We will be happy at any point to expand on any of these or other topics. We do want to thank the committee for getting the legislative process forward, and we are here to answer any questions you have and participate as this goes forward. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. I'm going to go ahead and call up the next panel. Committee, I know we have a few of us for sure that have other committee commitments after this. I don't know if there's anyone that is willing to stay to finish this agenda, or should I just I guess what I'm going to do is I have Richard Engstrom, Dave Ball, and Todd Baker, and Craig Campbell can't come back, so I'm going to pull him up, and then the rest of the group that I have is Brian, Chris, and I'm going to butcher the name, Bob Stacey, Carl Rohde, and Bob Russell. And it, are there any that can't come back on Friday? Okay, I have Carl, then we'll get to Carl. And if the rest of you don't mind, that way we'll have at least the full committee to hear your testimony and not a couple people. So if that's okay with you, then you're okay? Okay. All right. So thank you, gentlemen.
Good afternoon. If Madam Chair, if I might start, introduce our folks. My name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. I'm here with OCAPA's Chair Dave Bull and immediate past Chair Todd Baker. We kind of have talked about, so we're not going to be redundant at all. Each one of us has specific points that we want to make, and it was good that we had lunch together to make this as brief and pointed as possible. As a general matter, Oregon produces about 50 million tons of aggregate, and just on the aggregate side, we employ 3,220 employees. Our production, from what we're seeing, is 30% to 40% down from that. So, pointing out what Bob Shiprack was demonstrating, things are not looking good on the industry side of things. As a general matter, every person uses about 12 to 15 tons of aggregate material in the state, and our multiplier is one of the highest when you look at a dollar spent on aggregate to what's generated downstream of 2.58. We're a significant component to the industry when you think of only 3,220 people and then the whole construction business that's supported by that. It demonstrates the importance of the industry. With that, I'm just going to go to the points that I want to make, and I kind of liked the way Representative Berger talked about puts and takes, so I'm going to use it in that terms. One of the takes, I think, is that the committee should look and resist bonding. Bonding comes with immediate bump in projects, but it has downstream consequences, and the aggregate industry has not been supportive of that particular way of financing our highways. Essentially, what you do is you get extremes in flow of things for the industry. Things, you know, you get a lot of money and then not very much, and you're paying off that bond for periods of time, and that robs the highway fund. Resist bonding. A put is keep the project size small. If you make them too big, a lot of Oregon companies cannot bid on them, especially the smaller ones, and then you get the international folks, the Bechtels and folks like that, that come in and bid on them and swoop up the projects. If you want to make it a stimulus package as well as take care of the highways, try to keep the project small so people on all four corners of the state that build roads can participate in the package. The last one's a take. out of this, and that is, as a general matter, we like to see the projects go to bid and not go to funding public works departments around the state. The best use of the money is going to be out doing projects, getting it in the hands of the private sector so that they can do what they do and actually improve the roads. When it goes to the public works departments, they end up doing that, and we grow that particular sector and not support the private sector. And with that said, they don't those projects tend to be more pothole filling, things of that nature, and not actual construction type projects. So resist growing public works out of these bills, and more on direct contracts. So money goes directly to contract. I appreciate the vision the vision comments that came from everybody else, and there's no reason to expand on that. So what we did is we knew that was going to happen. We want to hit some direct points that think are important components of the bills that you guys look at. Great.
You'll need one of the mics, Sarah.
Oh, all right. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Dave Bull. As Rich said, I'm currently chair of OCAPA. I'm also serving currently as president of Morse Brothers, now called Knife River. We're an aggregates-based company that operates from Eugene on up to Portland and then up Highway 30 to St. Helens. We have about 25 locations where we produce aggregate. We produce ready-mixed concrete, We produce asphalt. We produce the big pre-stressed concrete beams for bridges that you see going down the highway. We produce asphalt, and we have road construction crews that that build the roads that you see. I appreciate the chance to speak to you today. We are a major, most of our projects, over 50% of our projects, are public projects with municipalities, with ODOT. And so your success on coming up with a funding plan is our lifeblood. It's very important to us. I've spent the last couple of days looking through the Transportation Vision Committee draft, and the one thing I can tell you is I've come to appreciate the complexity of the task before you. And so I'm gonna just basically say one thing to you, because I can't answer all the questions that you're going to confront, but I can focus in on the one thing that stuck out because it affects me, and that is that currently our system, Oregon system of roads and bridges, which I believe is our state's largest asset, is underfunded. The maintenance of those assets are underfunded to the tune of about $500 million a year. And so I've looked through this, and I've looked at your plan, or the plan of this committee, to try to come up with additional funding, and I applaud that. We currently pay at our company about $1 million a year in road fees, fuel taxes. We're willing to pay more because we believe that this fund needs to be there to support this infrastructure. My single concern that I would leave you with is that when I look through the places that you want to spend that money, I don't believe that enough of it is going back to maintaining our core. You heard another gentleman here talk about it as our backbone, the backbone of our infrastructure, our system of existing bridges and highways. You're trying to do an awful lot with this program, and my one fear is that not enough of it goes to maintain our largest asset in Oregon. And so that is the main thing. As you focus on all these things, sometimes there are an issue is so complex, I would like to ask you to focus on making sure that we can maintain our primary asset, and that's our existing system of roads and bridges. And I would like to finish by saying that if I can be of any assistance to you, if you need industry data or information or an opinion from industry, I would make myself available. This is the lifeblood of our company and our industry, so I will support you any way that I can. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee representatives, I guess Dave and I are probably the only ones who weren't involved in the visioning process. My name is Todd Baker. I'm with Baker Rock Resources. We are a much smaller version of Morris Brothers and Knife River. I'm a third generation in the business that my grandfather started. We have five locations, primarily in the Willamette Valley. Our headquarters is in Beaverton, Columbia County, and Yamhill County. I'm actually representing the 66 people that we've laid off so far. Normally, last year at this time, we were running about 158 full-time folks. Now, you know, we're down to, I think, 92. We've still got about another 10 people that are working 5 to 10 hours a week. We're really struggling. Last February, our primary business is in Beaverton and on Farmington Road, a large quarry. And last February, we sold 48,000 tons of material in February, and that was the lowest of the three-year previous average. This February, we're at 6,200. So you can go from 48,000 down to 6,200 tons. It's completely dead. We do, you know, residential, everything, and it's completely dead. The point I want to make is our lack of spending then in our business, because we're decreasing our office supplies, we're decreasing our landscaping, our office cleaning is every 2 or 3 weeks now instead of every week. That's trickling all the way down to those folks. Last year we spent $2 million on capital expenditures. This year we're planning on $325,000. We'll survive. We're a conservative company. We've had slow growth throughout the years. We don't have a private helicopter. We don't have, you know, a bunch of race cars. We're a conservative company. That's how I was brought up. That's how my dad and my father is. But the two comments I would make is that right now, with the money, any money that the state spends, you're going to get tremendous value. anytime there's 15 bidders bidding on a $7 or $8 million project, that project's cheap. You're getting a great value. I know because our company just picked up a ODOT job on 26 that I think includes the first federal stimulus dollars, a cable barrier. I'm telling you, it's cheap. It's a cheap project. It's to get my people back to work. And the last thing that I would just reiterate is that I've been dealing with some counties and cities that we deal with and them purchasing their own equipment. And I had a discussion with one of the mayors, and before they were buying asphalt from me, and I actually make more money that way because my trucks, they rent the trucks for me, and I supply the asphalt, and my crews can go do something else, and I charge them list price. And they've decided to buy their own paver, but I went to them anyways, and I said, you know, I don't think you should. I think you should put it out for bid. If they put it out for bid, I could lose. Knife River could get the job, and I won't get any of it. And so I was really going to them as a citizen saying, you're not spending the taxpayer dollars, their money, the right way by buying your own equipment and doing it because you cannot do it as efficiently as private enterprise can. That particular type of work, that construction work. So I would encourage, reiterate what Rich said, that any money that's spent, please use it to put it out into the contracting community and not use it to build public works departments. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I know you're itching. Well, go ahead and get Greg.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA and its 700,000 members. I don't often use the term 700,000 members, and I'll get back to that in a moment. I also want to thank the governor for putting together the Vision Committee and the two other committees that I served on. I will admit there were several times during that process that I wasn't so thankful that the governor had done so. However, I also wanted to thank him for providing Hans and Chris, and I would be remiss in not thanking him for appointing Pat Wrighton to be the chair of the Vision Committee, not only because he's a client of mine, but also because he actually came to the table with an outsider's perspective. He understood the complexity that he was facing from where he came from, and he had a tremendous amount of patience for those who were around the table. And that was quite a bit more diverse than we'd had before in transportation discussions. We had, for the first time, not only cars and trucks, the people who build the roads and the people who manage the roads, but we also had pedestrians and bikes. It took us a while before the bikes, trucks, pedestrians, and truckers were convinced that the other people weren't just there to use our roads that we had an entitlement to. And, of course, we also had the environmental community present, which was not there before. And it also took us a while to realize that they were not crazy people who had an overly abundant affection for foliage and that we were a group of evil special interests who wouldn't know a marbled merlet if we had just gone through a three-month seminar on the process. But let me go back a little bit about the 700,000 members of AAA. I bring that up because our members are in John Day, they're in Elmira, they're in Coos Bay, they're in Cannon Beach, they're in Portland, they're in Eugene. And when we talk about passing a tax to work on our infrastructure, we're cognizant of the fact that these are people who have perspectives that are as diverse as the places that they come from. So when we are representing them about whether or not we're going to be taxing them, and we're one of the two highway taxpayers, we have to make sure that the squeeze is worth the juice. And after going through the vision process and knowing what we're going to be going through in this legislative process, I'm convinced that at the end of this process, we are going to have a package that's going to create meaningful jobs, and a number of our members are concerned whether or not they're going to have a job next week or next month. That money is going to create not just short-term jobs for construction, but will create an enhancement to what is really an economic life structure for enhancing our economy. It's the lifeblood of our economy. By eliminating choke points, we'll enhance our ability to move people and goods in the state, hopefully better than we have been able to in the past. And by investing in maintenance, we've come to the realization that the longer you allow maintenance to sit, the more expensive it is when you finally get to it. So we need to be up front and get to dealing with our maintenance problems. One of the other areas that came true to us as we discussed the transportation system is that it truly needs to be looked at as a system, not just a highway system, but a transportation system as a whole, which means we need to make sure that we're integrating all of the modes in how we move people and goods. And one of the things that AAA wants to make sure is in this package is that by the time we get done, there needs to be a dedicated funding source for those modes other than highway. The highway fund itself doesn't cover the needs that the highway has, but it certainly doesn't cover the needs of those other modes that need to be taken care of. I will indicate that we have a preference in the means of tax that goes to one of our closely held beliefs about cost responsibility. We believe that if you're going to tax people, you should tax them fairly based upon their use of the system. It used to be a time that I used to have to fight for that. Not anymore. When you get into a room of these folks, everyone knows about cost responsibility. They understand everyone's going to pay their fair share. I bring it up only because how refreshing it is now that when we talk about it, it's ingrained into the way we talk about the transportation system. But part of that is emphasizing the preference for doing use taxes, like gas taxes, rather than registration and title fees, which are essentially access taxes unless they're being used to pay for administrative costs. So I would encourage you to go down that road. I don't envy this committee the work that it's got to do, but I do want to thank you for your efforts, and I want to let you know that you're not alone. We'll be here through the whole process right behind you and helping you out any way we can. I want to thank you very much, Madam Chair, both for your participation in the Vision Committee and also for allowing me to come out of turn up today. So thank you very much.
Welcome. And I know we have a question from Representative Shoffler, or maybe a political statement.
I'd say both, Madam Chair. Thank you for indulging me. You know, Rich, Mr. Angstrom, I'm glad you pointed out the fact that we all use gravel. I've been using it to make a living and make money since I was 14 years old. And whether you're one of the 1,100 Associated General Contractors or whether you're a member of 1,000 Friends of Oregon, you use gravel. Everybody and everybody in between. So I just want to reemphasize that. My question, Madam Chair, thank you for indulging me, is I have some constituents who can, they want to grind up old shingles, create, that one of them is my immediate backdoor neighbor adjacent to my house. They want to grind up old shingles, do it in Oregon, put it into roads, and create jobs here, and interestingly enough, keep this stuff out of the landfill. So my question is, does happen? You're the road experts. Does that sound like something we could get done in this state?
It's happening. Yeah, right. It's happening. So two of our asphalt plants, one in Portland, one in Eugene, we take either the virgin shingles from a manufacturer that are blems, or we take those that come off of roofs, grind them up, and they become part of asphalt product. It's not approved yet on ODOT work, but it is for private work. But, you know, landfills also, there's a use. They like the shingles ground up, and they use it for cover layers in between their liners and all of that. So there are other uses for shingles as well that are
Madam Chair, my point was, these folks want it to be approved for ODOT projects. Because they do road
work. Got that on the record.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair.
Shoffler.
And I'm going to go.
Thank
now.
You, gentlemen. And, Carl, my apologies. Yeah. Yes. And we're losing people.
Chair Beyer, I appreciate it. I'm going to see if I can actually get someone to cover for me for a meeting on Friday so that I can come and address
Okay, that would be great. I think you'd have a much better audience.
Thank you.
Thank you. My apologies. And with that, we are adjourned.
I'll touch base with that.